Hello and welcome to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. If you were listening to the show last week, you would have heard part one of Audience with the Ghostfinder, Blackshaw's first ever produced radio play, and I will be playing part two of that very shortly. Also on the show this week, we have some poetry coming up, a very interesting review of a pantomime from the perspective of a very confused Australian man, and a piece of new writing by Marion Powell called SMS. But now, the very much anticipated part two of Audience with the Ghostfinder.
Audience with the Ghostfinder by M.J. Starling. Based on characters and ideas originally by William Hope Hodgson and H.P. Lovecraft. In an attempt to free Miss Florence Allenby from her family's curse, Carnacki had her pass the night in the Electric Pentacle. But Carnacki miscalculated. Something monstrous attacked the Pentacle, and Miss Allenby fled its failing defences.
She was within my reach, yes, physically, but I couldn't know what might still be abroad in that room. She'd been taken so swiftly. I crouched there, at the edge of the circle, with a perfectly horrible pringling sensation racing up and down my arms and across my scalp, trying desperately to screw up some courage, to move forward, to brave the danger and go to her aid, but I was stiff, simply rigid with terror. I couldn't coax myself to venture even one small finger outside the defence. I wonder, have you ever felt anything like it? Could you even imagine the feeling? A dread that manacles your very bones, your very thoughts. And the longer it holds you, the stronger its hold becomes. I saw that she was breathing, and the need for action seemed immediately less urgent. And as it were, the shackles cinched tighter still. I couldn't reach the bell, and I reasoned that to shout for help would be to expose others to the same horror, perhaps to seal another's fate, as I seemed to have sealed hers. And so I simply watched over her till daylight, fooling myself that I was doing a worthy duty.
She turned every head when she made her debut, you know. Her independence. And now, Tilbury is sitting by her bedside, sponging drool off her chin. My daughter, Carnacki. My Florence. When I left the room, she was giggling to herself. Giggling, Carnacki. Like a mad woman in some novel.
It was my fault.
I know.
It all went so wrong, so fast. I could hardly think. It never even occurred to me that she might leave the circle.
Robert's father bound him to a chair to stop him removing the charm. He broke four of his fingers freeing himself. Robert's aunt, Elsbeth, the firstborn of her generation, eluded her parents, her grandfather, the colonel, and her nanny the night she succumbed. They didn't find her till morning, slumped in a cellar they didn't even know they had. I told you Florence would be tempted, and I told you she couldn't resist it herself. You told me your rituals and silly contraptions were the solution we'd been missing. I put my faith in you.
I said I couldn't guarantee success.
You didn't say you would hasten failure. You did a good job, sounding like you knew what you were doing, Mr. Carnacki. But I see now that was nothing but hot air.
Actually...
What is it?
I don't think history's quite repeating itself line for line this time. My involvement does seem to have changed one thing.
My daughter has lost her mind, Mr. Carnacki. Whatever you think you've achieved is immaterial.
I've heard the cry.
You can't have.
So there's no precedent for an outsider?
None. The Herald's cry is a family curse. You are not family.
Nevertheless...
Nevertheless what? If you're looking for sympathy, you've got some
nerve. No, it's not that, of course. No, I don't know yet what it means, but it must mean something. If this has changed, then maybe not Miss Allenby's, but I don't know, Perhaps the next victim's fate might be changed as well?
If you really have heard the cry, the next victim will be you.
That had occurred to me. I wonder if I might borrow the charm just until tomorrow morning?
Do as you like with it. You've made sure my Florence is no longer in need of it. Though I can't imagine it'll do you much good. You've less faith even than she had.
I believe in powers beyond the physical realm. I believe in abnatural dangers and protections.
You believe nothing. With you, everything must be proven or disproven. You do not allow for things to simply be so. I hope your philosophy brings you solace when your mind flees your body. I shall be with what's left of my daughter. Good day to you, Mr. Carnacki.
And so, here we are.
What do you mean?
That's the whole tale up till now.
Well, but you left the Allenbys first thing this morning. You must have done something since.
Nothing of consequence. I ran a few experiments on the charm, but only really so I wouldn't have to sit still and think about what happened.
What sort of experiments? Did you discover anything?
Oh, everything I could think of that wouldn't destroy it. I made a spiritual focus about it with my spectrum circles. I subjected it to various sonic and electromagnetic vibrations. I put it under a microscope, x-rayed it, heated it, cooled it.
And?
It's a good deal more than just feathers and twine. Further than that, I couldn't tell you. Remember, I heard the cry. It's hard to take accurate readings when things keep drifting in front of the instruments.
You seem to be coping remarkably well.
Don't lie to me, Dodson. I know when I'm in a funk.
Right. But there's no need to talk yourself further into it.
At any rate, by evening I still wasn't getting anywhere with my only clue. So I realised it. I'd simply have to brazen it out in the electric pentacle, just like Miss Allenby.
You ought to have rung me up earlier.
Yes, most likely.
You can see it now, I suppose, that place.
Vividly.
And the creature?
Yes, the scavenger is circling. It scents weakness. Doesn't seem as impatient as last night, but then it must be used to going years between meals.
Perhaps if it's not hungry, it'll let you drift on by.
Unlikely. I can only think of one plausible reason for the thing to suddenly change its Allenby-only diet. I enraged it by trying to deny it Miss Allenby, and perhaps consciously, or perhaps on some vicious impulse, it's decided that I shall suffer for it.
Horrible.
For me, if it succeeds, undoubtedly. But in the scheme of things, it's no more horrible than the dog who bites the man who taunts it by taking away its dinner, if I may put it like that.
An angry dog would just nip you and have done with it. There'd be none of this awful waiting, thinking about what's coming. It doesn't seem like an animal instinct to me, Carnacki. It feels like malevolence.
Oh, the wait isn't so bad. How many men ever get to observe such a remote realm as I'm now seeing? And thanks to you, I can study it. Almost at my leisure. No need to worry about my physical body misbehaving in the meantime. I've enough observations to found a whole monograph on.
If you make it through the night with your wits intact.
Dodson, you aren't helping.
Good grief, I'm sorry, I didn't. But I can't help getting indignant on your behalf. It's all so damned arbitrary. Why the Allenbys? Why you? Animal instinct? Some silly quirk of personal electric tensions? Such nonsense cannot have such real, horrible effects on people. I quite refuse to credit it. Perhaps all that's left is to finish that whiskey. What did I do with it?
Dodson, what was that you just said?
Oh, I was just going to fix us something more to drink, that's all.
No, before that. What was it you said? Say it again, will you?
Say what again? When?
Such nonsense cannot really affect people, or some such, and I quite refuse to credit it.
I know, defeatist of me. Sorry. Forget I said it.
Forget indeed. Dodson, you are a marvel. I do believe you have it in you to save my skin tonight.
Surely not. I mean, if I can, of course, but how so?
Arkwright, Jessop, Taylor, and Dodson, my friends, my sounding board, my council of war. Why you, do you think, Dodson? Why you tonight and not any of the others?
I'm sure I don't know.
I took a gamble on your unique insight, a gamble that appears to have paid off.
Carnacki, what on earth are you getting at?
Dodson, my friend, you are unique among our little cabal in that you've never quite shaken the suspicion that I'm a complete fraud.
What? Now, hang on, that just isn't
true. No, listen, this is important.
I don't mean it when I call you that, it's just a joke.
Then you are a fool.
I beg your pardon?
Arkwright heard the unknown last line of the Sarmar ritual.
uttered by the abhuman priests in Incantation of Rai. Jessup survived that ordeal aboard the Mort Zestus. Even young Taylor has a measure of innate psychic sight. When we all sit round the fire and I spin you chaps some yarn about some unusual occurrence, they simply listen, because their own experiences tell them that such things are not impossible. But you, Dodgson, your senses, your experiences, your existence has been entirely mundane.
As if Arkwright didn't remind me enough of that.
I'm not trying to slight you, you dunderhead. I'm saying your judgment is unsullied. There is a solution to this horrid business, and I can't see it, because I'm too used to accepting impossible things as fact. But you can. You can see the way out. What have I missed, Dodgson? What doesn't add up?
I don't know. I don't know, all right? I just don't know.
Think. You do know. Just think.
Whatever happened to keeping a perfectly open mind?
What's that to do with anything?
You have told us 1,001 times never to dismiss a thing out of hand just for seeming impossible. Are you saying you expect me to ignore that?
I'm saying it's likely more things seem impossible to you than seem impossible to me, or Arkwright, or the others. I'm saying that you must steel yourself consciously not to scoff at things that we simply accept. I'm saying you notice more.
But I have always...
Did you want them to be true?
What?
All those yarns I spun you all by the fire. Hauntings and monsters and curses and possession and death. Did you want to believe that they were true?
I always believed that you were honest. Didn't I say so?
That's not what I asked.
Did I want such ghastly things to be real, you mean? Did I personally wish for young Aster to be devoured by the Black Veil, or poor Baines to be dragged to hell by the Hog? What kind of man do you think I am?
A loyal one, but a skeptic at heart.
Perhaps you're right.
I'd stake my life on it.
What was that?
Never mind that. Concentrate. What doesn't add up?
I don't know.
The slightest thing. Anything that gave you pause.
Well,
yes.
How do you explain the creature, the bird I mean, still being able to detect Miss Allenby despite the electric pentacle? That shouldn't have been possible.
Quite right. Quite right. Perhaps it's like hiding under a sheet in an empty room. One is concealed, but the hiding place is obvious.
Are you quite sure nothing's...
Let me worry about the apparatus. Keep going.
Well, I still don't understand how this so-called family curse comes to affect you at all.
Yes. Good. That's the part that seems strangest to me, too. I suspect if we can discover why the behaviour of the phenomenon has changed now, after generations of consistency, we shall find the key to the whole business.
Then there's the matter of the charm.
No, Dodgson. I think we've found the right line of inquiry if we can just focus.
It's just not like you, that's all.
What's not?
Do you trust it to protect you? Suppose you must. We've established that the pentacle can't hide you.
Hang on, slow down. Why wouldn't I trust the charm?
Well, let's see. Provenance unknown, hasn't worked in living memory, testing inconclusive. Why would you trust it?
It would have saved Miss Allenby if she'd kept her head and kept it on.
Funny how everyone seemed to believe that. You, Miss Allenby, skeptics both, supposedly. If keeping it on's going to save you, then why are we even having this conversation? Why didn't you simply ask me to, I don't know, tie you up and sit on you until morning? May I see the note?
Pardon me?
The note that came with the charm. It's in your pocket there. May I see it?
Whatever for?
Just indulge me.
If you insist.
What language is this supposed to be?
English.
Don't be absurd.
Whomsoever of my kin doth find himself
That's
in need of more than
That's not what it says, Carnacki.
Of course it is. Read it.
I can't. What is this script? Arabic? Hieroglyph?
Are you quite in control of your senses?
Are you? Give me the charm.
What?
The charm and the note are handed down together, you said.
What of it?
Hiding under a sheet in an empty room and holding up a lantern.
You're supposed to make sure I keep it
on. Give it to me. Give it to me, Carnacki.
It's got to you. You're mad.
What happened to the power of my mundane existence?
Confound it, Dodgson. What's got into you?
Like you. Nothing left but ashes. Has that done it?
Can't hear it anymore.
Hear what?
The herald. I don't see it overhead either.
Then I was right. The curse has nothing to do with the Allenby family. It was something in the charm.
What one might term a haunted or cursed artifact, masquerading as a hereditary spiritual entanglement or family curse. Of course the victims tore the thing off the moment they realised it was guiding the Herald toward them, but the realisation always came too late. And if the charm were of the Herald's own being, as it were, a part of the creature itself, then of course it would remain uninsulated by the electric pentacle.
You're yourself once again, I see.
Myself, yes. I think so, but not yet whole.
You see the chasm still?
Yes. Though as long as the pentacle holds, without the charm to give me away, I should knit back together quite naturally. I may yet write that monograph.
What in heaven's name
is
that?
Dodson, take my gun. Where are you, Dodson?
Why? What for? What's happening?
I can't see. I may miss. I may hit you.
I heard it, Carnacki. Is it coming for me now, too?
No. Perhaps. I doubt it can discriminate. Take my gun.
What for?
It's coming here, Dodson. It's lost track of me in the abyss, so it means to manifest itself on the physical plane. Death is preferable to whatever it has in mind. Where are you?
I won't do it.
You must. I'm not afraid. I've seen beyond the veil. There's nothing there.
I refuse.
Dodson?
Is this it?
The center, Dodson. Back to back now. We have to ride it out.
Did you see? Ghostly faces in the dark, watching.
I saw. I've said before there are entities that sometimes intervene when a human spirit is threatened by the outer monstrosities. Of course, it doesn't do to count on these things,
Carnacki.
But I suppose the whole business with stranding spirits in the outer circle was a way to circumvent the notice of those powers.
Tom!
William?
Must you?
Must I what?
We're alive, aren't we? Can you just leave it at that this once?
Perhaps I'd better.
You're working it out in your head, I can tell.
I'll need an explanation ready for Arkwright. You know what he's like.
The first time I got lost, when I was just a little girl, we were by the sea. I was exploring the rock pools and I must have gotten carried away. When I looked back, it was dark and I couldn't see Mother. The tide was in and nothing around me looked familiar anymore. I thought I might be out there among the rocks all night, alone. It still makes my heart jump just thinking about it.
I know the feeling.
Well, it's like that. Only more. Imagine not being able to see home even as a distant star.
I doubt I can even begin to.
Are you envious? Where did it all start?
We'll never know.
But you have a theory. You can't not have theories about things.
I don't know. Perhaps some ancestor of yours got on the wrong side of some shaman or mystic with knowledge of the unseen world.
Someone like you.
Or perhaps it was meant for someone else entirely. And your ancestor just happened to fall afoul of it. The one responsible may not have foreseen how it would come to be passed down through the generations. Though if that part was deliberate.
You are envious. I can tell. Is that why you lured it back?
That is not what I was trying to do.
Still, I know where home is now. Everything looks familiar again. I've seen such horrors and such wonders. Would you like to hear about them before I go? Will you visit once in a while?
I'm sorry you went through what you did. I ought to have seen what was happening.
Don't feel bad, old chap. You had a far worse night than I.
Hmm? Sorry, Dodson, I was miles and miles away.
You quite all right?
I'm alive, aren't I?
And in one piece again.
Just about.
Thank you.
Thank me? Why?
It's thanks to your precautions that I'm safe.
Suppose you're right. That's something, at least.
Audience with the Ghost Finder by M.J. Starling. starring Alexander Pankhurst as Carnacki, the ghost finder. Ellie Pitkin played Mrs. Judith Allenby, Caridwen Smith was Miss Florence Allenby, and Richard Stratton was Dodgson. Sound design and editing was by Andrew Crane, using original sound design by David Turnbull. The play was directed by Ellie Pitkin and produced by Helen Johnson, with special thanks to Vicky Weston and Aisha Chapman.
You have just been listening to part two of Audience with the Ghost Finder. Now, if you missed part one last week, or you'd like to listen again, it will be up on the Blackshaw blog, and we will play it again sometime later on in the year on the Blackshaw Arts Hour. If you want to go onto the blog and listen to it, you can head over to www.blackshawonline.com/blog, and it will be up there in the next coming days. Next up, I'm going to play some poetry. The first two poems in this collection are by Daisy Thurston Ghent and are both untitled, and the last two are by Owen Collins.
When they asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I told them the ocean. They said, that's all very well, but how will that help you stay grounded? I said, on the contrary. I should be grounded deep beneath the world's fiercest surface. That those who seek to take a piece must first peek at some pretty scary creatures. That those with faint hearts must be cautious before they take to me. That my waters rule off the unruly and reckless, yes, but let's consider other options, they said. But I kept going. People should never approach the ocean lightly. She can be mighty, frightening. Her mood swings alone have accounted for many lives during her time, and many sailors have been lost to her, either in flesh or in mind. They sigh. Try to visualize. I am. But right now, I feel every splinter from the shipwreck. Right now, I'm just hiding from the shark tank. Right now. It'll take deep-sea divers just to find me. I pride myself on imagining such a role model as she. I told them if I were the ocean, yeah, I would surge. I would rage like a great beast because my complexities hide monsters in their shadows. Real monsters down deep. I can feel I'm really going off on one, but I've already begun, so I just carry on with, you know, it took scientists hundreds of years to discover the giant squid, tempt him from his bed, rub out the rumours, settle the madness of the fishermen. The kraken lives again, they said. I turn. Have you heard of deep sea giantism? Where crabs are meters high, octopi are 10 feet wide, and stingrays swim like 5-foot glider planes, casually as anything, real life giants. Can you imagine what else I'm hiding? They said, what about cotton candy and crabbing? I said, you're thinking of the seaside, the kind that offer pony rides, not the deep blue that children pencil in vain, never quite finishing in time for the class assignment. I can tell they are growing tired. Careers department, patients wearing thin. I said, fine. Fine. Put me in your system. Plug me in. I'll be anything. As long as they will let me swim. A 6-year-old boy, with 2 fingers up his nose, knows more about space than I do. Stood across his stabilizer push bike like it's the Harley Davidson he used to ride across the Milky Way. He's full of facts that make my head explode. While I tend to spend a lot of time just looking up. In total wonderment, puzzled by my own magnificent insignificance to the excellence of the universe, I am not a necessary element. In fact, I barely make a dent. but I'll wander to the ends of this levitating, unbreakable gobstopper in the mouth of something far greater, and when the Earth's exploded us to particles, spun off its axis like a spinning top, I know the friends who will join me in the electric race through the mains, fast-tracked to the heart, molecules dissolved into my bloodstream, tiny iron filings. Someone once told me that everyone you love who's passed away someday becomes the face in the moon's craters. For years, I'd lay awake at sleepovers, tell my friends, you know, that man in the moon was my dad. And I'd lose a lot of sleep that way. These days, I sit on sunken sofas with friends in drunken stupors who say the universe is so empty. A sentence that perplexed me. Still they vent, shout their mouths off at the solar system, nothing matters, they're pissed off at the planets. Stick up two fingers to the sun, they're jealous of the stars, because even though they die off fast, they still get to burn fiercely me. Well, I've got plenty of friends I'd waste wishes on. I'm scared they'll burn out just as quickly, and yeah, some days my insignificance makes me sickly, but there's a greatness in being small and humanly. You know, Jupiter has four moons that all look like speckled mini eggs. And who else can make that analogy but we, the human beings? So you'll find me forever hunting in the garden, on my knees like a child at Easter, just trying to make sense of this existence. But no one howls to the moon these days, do we? These days it's all phone calls and mic stands and Siri, and I'm seriously considering the myriads of blinking luminaries that make light of bigger things. They don't care how bright the days get. They know the night is always dark, and still they never douse, not even for a moment. I know so little of this universe. But still, I play my part as ignorant human, taking nothing but small steps. Downplaying my greatest achievements is a leap forward in a race I sometimes don't even believe in. I don't remember agreeing to take part, complain of false starts and fixes that put me off my game, making bets on my behalf. I tell this kid, if I amount to even half a star, I'll be satisfied. And he looks confused, unable to challenge me through facts about Mars and spatial physicality. He doesn't think of human practicality, right? He doesn't need to. I tell him not to lose his spirit, and he says he must get home for dinner. And then he rides into a sunset that he wholly understands. When I was his age, we'd sing, he's got the whole world in his hands, he's got the whole wide world in his hands. I seem to spend a lot of time looking up. Remind me next time. I need to show you something.
This is a poem called Related to Love. There's a popular online rhyming dictionary, which is a bit rubbish. But as when you search for a word, as well as giving you like two words that rhyme with that word, it will give you a list of words related to it. And for some reason, a couple of months ago, I was trying to find rhymes for the word love, beyond the obvious, sort of glove and shove and dove. And then I noticed the sort of list of words related to love, and it was about 500 words long, with some interesting words that you wouldn't necessarily relate to love. And so I wrote them all into a poem. So it's not really something I've written, but I've sort of put it together. It is an Airfix kit poem, in a way. This is called Related to Love. Abandoned, absence, absolutely, abuse, abyss, accept, addiction, alcohol, ambition, and America, always amazing, Andrew and Andrea, angels, animals, anniversary, anxious, annoying, anything, apathy, art, arts, ash, ashes, ashamed, Asian, assurance, and ass, bad back, baby, bananas and baseball, balcony, beautiful, barred, bear and bags, cupid, crying, clothes and coffee, coke and college and comedy, cheap cheese and chicken and communication, Christmas, companionship, concentration, colours and cowboys and complication, cum and cream and copulation, dancing and dreaming and damage and darkness, deception, depression, death and divorce, dinner and diamonds, devotion, discover, drama and destiny and ducks. Of course. Erotic Eclipse, Fidelity Fiction, Gangsters, Garages, Hockey and History, Impossible, Innocence, Justice and Jungle, Kissing and Kingdom, Learning and Longing, Magician and Marathon, Matrix and Memory, Mills, Miles, Mistresses, Mint and Mystery, Nervous and Nude, Not Normal and Nuts, Oasis and Opium, Orgasm, Ouch, People, Perfection, Penguins, Poetry, Ponies, Protection, Questions and Quality, Racism, Radio, Records, Rejection, Romantic Rhetoric, Revenge and Reflection, Shakespeare, Silence, Sugar and Spice, Skateboards and Shoulders and Students and Skies, Sunrise, Sunset, Sunday, Sun, Somebody, Someday, Somewhere, Someone, Touching Togetherness Through Thunder and Tide, Unique, Undying, Understanding, Unite, Victory and Vanity, Values and Violence, Victims and Virgins and Vixens, Vaginas, Winter, Wind and Wet Weather, Warm and Warmth and Whiskey and Wine, Years and Yesterday, Zero and Zone, Happiness, Everything, Yours and Mine. My favourite word currently in the English language is hydrocatch. I'm not even sure it's a proper word, but I saw it on a sign at Butlin's once in the swimming pool. Butlin's Minehead. And in the swimming pool, they have several hydrocatches, which wasn't... I'd always wondered if there was a name for it. It's that bit at the end of a long water slide. It's just... It's always longer than it needs to be. And you always think, oh, if I pick up a load of speed going down the slide, I'll get right to the end. And you never do. You barely get halfway through. It's just like the big sort of trough of water that you sort of land in at the end of a slide. Yeah, so there's this kind of... It's quite cool because they're slightly deeper than you think. They're slightly choppier than you expect just because of all the water coming down. There's kind of a bit of a current. And so there is a slight sense of panic that you've got to get yourself out before the next person comes down, even though the lifeguards won't send the next one down until you're out. But it's still quite a kind of exciting experience, the hydrocatch. and it's, you know, it's not a very popular word. As I say, I'm not sure it's a proper word, but I thought I'd write it into a poem so that one day, in a sort of like Oxford English Dictionary, they might say, oh yeah, first used in Owen Collins' poem, Hydrocatch, like first recorded use. And I'll say, no, it was on a sign at Butlin's, but secretly be quite pleased. So last summer, me and my girlfriend went to Centre Parks. Yeah, and they have a lot of cool water slides there at the sort of lagoon, several with their own hydrocatch. And I sort of said, as my girlfriend was just heading down the water slide, wait for me in the hydrocatch, which seemed like a good opening line to a poem. So judge for yourselves. This is called Hydrocatch. Wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love, in our oasis while the condensation rains down from above. Beside the coruscating foam, beneath the temperature-controlled dome, in our subtropical home from home, wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love. Wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love, and imagine the seabirds swirling around us like doves. As the lifeguard looks on with panache and the wave machine begins to crash, stay to see the size of my splash, and wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love. Wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love, linger where the water alternates from calm to rough. I will flail down the flume, head first, feet first, I will zoom in order to get back to you, so wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love. Wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love, avoid the rapids where the unruly bathers thump and shove, for the looping slides will bring me back, for the joins give you a stingy back, so before you take your dinghy back, wait for me in the hydrocatch, my love.
You're listening to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, and that was a collection of poems by our resident poets, Daisy and Owen. Next up, I'm going to play you a review by Corey Holes. Corey is a writer who you may have heard on the show before, and at the beginning of this year, he's went to his first ever pantomime, and he's written a review and recorded it for us to play. This is called Waking Up With No Pants, a young Australian boy's brave journey into the dark and unknown world of English pantomime theatre.
Matt Damon has had a wide and varied film career, and I can count myself as a fan of almost all his films, aside from the movie Green Zone, which I've not seen, nor do I intend to see, despite the many unforeseen changes my life and personal taste could undergo in the future. Digressions aside, as I was midway through the pantomime version of Jack and the Beanstalk put on by Epsom Theatre, for some reason my enjoyment of the play was compounded 100-fold by my recalling of the Matt Damon film Rounders and the film's tagline, in the game of life, play the cards you're dealt. Unfortunately, I've gone a bit Scorsese and begun to recap my adventure into the world of English pantomime in media res, so let me go back to where most good pantomimes start, at the beginning. Having only been exposed to the deep, dark world of pantomime through Ricky Gervais' show Extras and his hardly glowing portrayal of a pantomime version of Aladdin, which made the medium look slightly more enjoyable than watching 48 hours of competitive curling, seeing a pantomime was not at the top of my list of things to do when I arrived in the motherland from Australia. So when a co-worker and friend informed me that he was in a play, I thought that it would not only be terrific to go and support him, but also could be some unbelievable ammunition for my sniper-like wit. In other words, pantomime would not know what hit it when my elegant and amusing prose sent it packing back so far down the theatre pecking order that it would soon be begging to have as much respect as mime or those dudes who stand still on the street for hours with paint on them. This is the mindset with which I travelled the not inconsiderable journey from London to the Epsom Theatre. I had worked myself into so much of a I can't wait to have a sarcasm explosion all over this Panto's recap that I actually was in danger of blowing some of my jokes too early. I was getting so excited that I was throwing witty barbs at the Wetherspoons waiter who served us our edible food. You could barely hear the fruit machines over my mic drop. By the time I'd gotten into the theatre, I'd legitimately worked myself into a veritable frenzy akin to an atheist commenter on a Hillsong Church YouTube channel. It was an accepted reality in my mind that this would be the worst thing I had ever seen with my two eyes, so I was just sitting waiting for the theatrical stench to wash over me like one of the dust clouds in Interstellar. Imagine to my horror then that not only did I more than enjoy the preceding 2.5 hours of pantomime theatre, but I was literally touched how not one person in the theatre, despite the ridiculousness of what was being displayed, chose to react with snark. In a day and age where caustic remarks and sarcasm are almost second nature to most people, and a protective screen most people put up to ensure that they are not seen committing to the enjoyment or having an emotional response to anything at all. For further proof of this, attend a concert of a band rated higher than 7.5 on Pitchfork at a venue that is located near any kind of cafe that has found furniture. The groups of people that were in attendance at the play itself were enigmatically antithetic at best. Groups of teenage friends, young couples on dates, full families, apparently a hen's night, and all of the children in the area unlucky enough not to be chosen as one of the 450 extras on stage, made for an active, engaged, winking, and most importantly, snark-free audience. In fact, this change took a little while to catch on with me, as I still myself attempted to make snippy comments with the friend I attended the show with, who I had envisaged being akin to a catcher for my 100-mile-per-hour fastballs or my banter about the panto. However, it seems she too was not immune to the genuine magic of the pantomime. I remarked early on, more out of frustration, that I was not responding to one of the actors, saying, "I really don't like her." This was met with a completely earnest, "You're not meant to like her. She's the villain of the play." It was clear my negative mindset could not last any longer. I began to think of Matt Damon and the tagline aforementioned. Oftentimes when I gamble in games like poker, I used to get stuck on hands I wanted to play, tried to force the cards. I would not adapt to how the cards were being played on the table. This is why I'm a terrible player. And with this, there is also a distinct parallel with my initial foray into pantomime theatre. As I said, I was attempting to dislike the play, as I believed that this would make for more lols, when really, I should have just played the cards I was dealt in the game of life, or pantomime in this case, and enjoyed the lols right in front of my face. The pantomime was well directed, well put together, fantastically acted, incredibly performed from a musical perspective, and more than anything else, there were some genuinely funny moments, both for the kids and for the adults. Let me be clear, from an outsider's perspective, I still think it was one of the craziest things that I've ever seen. Things that I guess are standard in a normal pantomime just plain confused me, but nevertheless, this confusion did not annoy me or provide material for me like I had forecasted. Instead, just added another layer of mystique to the fairy tale. I'm of course under no illusion that this was not Shakespeare. My enjoyment of the piece may have been heightened by the fact that my expectations were at such a low level that any small surface improvement made the play seem like the hottest girl in school. That's right, in this analogy, the pantomime is the character of Lainey Boggs in She's All That. And while the comparison may be interesting to say the least, spare a thought for me while seeing this play. Like the movie Rounders, I was playing the hand that life dealt me and I was all in. I was enjoying the play, particularly the amount of delicious puns as well as the slightly absurdist and meta-humour that must have been going over the head of the 2 4-year-old girls who were sat in front of me. They seemed entirely too distracted by their light-up wands to notice the meta-textual jibes taking place on stage. Anyway, as I said, I'd leaned into Jack and the Beanstalk. That is, until, like the giant in the final stanza, I came crashing down to earth. This occurred when a 12-foot puppet slash man on stilts appeared with a 3-foot head as the giant on stage and started dancing to All About That Bass. While the children in front of me almost inserted their wand into their mother's eye out of sheer excitement, this was a bridge too far for me to accept. And I mean literally. It took me almost 3 days to come to terms with actually seeing it in my eyes, and that the moderately priced polo mints at Epsom Theatre I was devouring did not contain some kind of hallucinogen. This, however, was only one of the weak points for me in a strong play, and mainly because I'm still not entirely sure it took place. Weaker points aside, I still thoroughly enjoyed the pantomime. I went all in, and won a large figurative pot back. Will I return to a pantomime anytime soon? Well, as Kenny Rogers' immortal words about gambling state, with a pantomime subtext, I'm sure, you've got to know when to walk away. With this pure, magical theatrical experience in my back pocket, and a slightly brighter worldview, I think I've counted my chips and folded for the time being. But if there is anyone out there doing an exploratory look into English pantomime from an Australian perspective and has expectations set very low, or just a normal non-cynic who enjoys fun and laughter, then I cannot personally recommend pantomime enough.
That was a review by Corey Hulls explaining how confused and absurd he found his first ever panto experience to be. Next on the show, I'm going to play you a piece of new writing by Marion Powell. It is called SMS and is performed by Emily Jane Kerr.
It was such a nice date. A Shard. Fancy, eh? I used to be a bit scared of the Shard. I didn't want to go up in the lifts in case there was a storm and the wind blew out the glass and I fell out and drowned in Thames. Be a long way to fall. You might not even be dead when you hit the water, but you die if you fall in if you can't swim. I can't swim. It's not like there's lifeboat crews waiting to rescue people who've fallen in out of the Shard. And even if they did, I suppose a load of people would fall in at once and I doubt they'd get round to me till last, because that's what usually happens. Oh, that'd be just typical, that they'd forget about me or leave me till last and then I'd definitely drown and that'd be rubbish. It was his idea, of course. I wouldn't have even said yes, except A, it felt rude to say no, and B, he was hot. Oh my God, he looked like a footballer. A retired footballer, like one of them who lives in Portugal or Spain, all tanned, or maybe mixed race, but only a tiny bit. Like his granddad came from Barbados or Pakistan or something, and cropped hair and dark brown eyes and crinkly skin, but I didn't mind that because he bought me 2 cocktails. 2? He didn't even ask if I wanted the second one, he just saw my glass was empty and ordered another. Last time I went out, nobody bought me nothing. It were Nando's, and he said I should pay more because I'd ordered extra coleslaw. Loser. Sean isn't like that. I'm going to text him. Thanks for a lovely evening! ! I had a great time! Smiley face with a wink. Hope to do it again soon. Shall I put kisses on? It's only a first date. No, I will though. Kiss, kiss, kiss. 3's all right, I think. He hasn't texted me back yet. Which is weird, because I had this impression from him that he was, you know, a gentleman, old-fashioned, you know? And I know he fancied me. I definitely know that. I could feel he fancied me through his jeans when we said goodbye. When we said goodbye. When he had his tongue halfway down my throat and his hand down my bra, and it were a good job it were underneath my coat, or God knows what the people at the station would have thought. I don't care. I don't. I shouldn't have put the kisses, should I? What do you think? I drive myself mental, but this is the fun part, isn't it? The not knowing. This is what makes it fun. Nothing. He's probably met someone else. She's probably got better hair. She's probably got better clothes. She's probably thin. I wish you were on WhatsApp. You can tell when it's been read on WhatsApp. I hate that I don't know if he's even seen my text or if he's seen it and is just ignoring it. With Sean, I think he probably has seen it, and it probably is just that he's ignoring me, or too busy to reply, or some slag he met off Tinder, but he might not be. He might have had a heart attack. He's older, old enough for that, and he lives on his own. He's got a dog, I think, but maybe that only visits when his kids are there. And anyway, what could a dog do if he had a heart attack? Dogs are useless. It's not like Lassie. It's not like they can really do anything. I wonder if I should message him on Facebook. I found him on Facebook. It's weird, his settings are all open so you can nearly see everything, lots of photos. I've seen his kids, his ex, oh, she never smiles, no wonder he left her, his skiing holidays. I've never been skiing. There was a school trip once, but my mum said she didn't have any money, and even if she did, she wouldn't use it to send me on holiday, and definitely not skiing, because I just spend the whole time falling over like a massive, stupid spaz. Do you ski? Do you? Is it hard to learn? When did you learn? At school or something? I could learn. There's a place near Milton Keynes. Someone said you can go and get lessons. Can't be that hard. He's texted! Happy day! He said, thanks. Thanks for what? For the text? I had a lovely evening too. Oh, he probably just means thanks for that. Then, get this. A kiss! Well, that's good, isn't it? Because blokes don't always respond to the kisses, like, especially if they're masculine, and he is masculine, a manly man, so it must mean something. I know I put three, but one is good as a response, it really is. It's weird he hasn't suggested meeting again. I thought he might, because it's Wednesday now, so this would be an ideal time to arrange something for the weekend. Wonder if I should text him back. If you were me, would you text him now, or would you leave it? Or does it look needy to text him now? I could just put something funny, send a smiley face so he knows I've got it. What do you think? I don't know why you're not telling me. I know you might not think this is important. You're probably already married and you found the love of your life and you think I'm just some stupid cow, so why even bother to help me? Like, I don't deserve to be loved. I deserve to be loved. I'll wait till tomorrow. Oh, no, do you know what? I'll just send a little message so he knows I've got it. And if he likes me, then he'll think it's sweet, not desperate. He's probably insecure about all this stuff too. He hasn't texted me back. But that's all right. It's because I didn't ask him a question. Oh, I should have asked him a question. I'm an idiot. Why did you let me text him without asking a question? Why didn't you tell me to think about it for a few seconds more? God, you are useless, you lot. You're sacked. I met Kelly yesterday. You don't know her, do you? I do have other friends. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Kelly said that men nowadays expect women to take the lead, that they're all so useless, they need you to take the lead. Otherwise, they'll just stay in their pants playing computer games and looking at disgusting porn and barely even bothering to talk to women because they can get everything they want online and order pizza from that app off their phones and the whole world will die out. She goes on a bit, to be honest. But it's true that men are completely useless. So maybe he is sat in his pants playing computer games and looking at disgusting porn, not moping and feeling lonely and handsome like how I think about him. Anyway, she said I should just stop pissing about and ask him if he wants to see me again. I should just be clear. Oh, it's mad, isn't it? But I think, well, why not? At least that way I'm in control. Well, more in control. Like, if he doesn't get back to me, I know it's a no, not interested, you fat slag, rather than sitting here wondering. So I'm texting him. How are you? Smiley face. So he knows it's just a friendly greeting, not that I've been worried about him being lonely and sad. What are you doing on Friday? That's not trying too hard, is it? If he gets back to this, I'll know. I'll know he wants to see me again. And if he doesn't get back to me, I'll also know. I mean, I'll know like 97%. He might have lost his phone, or had a heart attack, or run himself over with one of his cars. Well, he's got two cars, BMWs. I saw him on Facebook. He must be minted. I have been busy. I've been sightseeing Morden, Colliers Wood. Sean lives that way. It's not why I went though. He just made it sound really nice and I've never been to that part of London, so... I wandered around the streets. I didn't know where his house was, wasn't trying to find it. I thought I might recognise it from off Facebook, but all the streets look the same. Oh, you think it'd be boring, just houses, but it was so interesting. Lots of people leave their curtains open, you can see inside. They all had big tellies and fireplaces and wooden floors. I wonder what it'd be like to live in a house. A whole house, not just some crappy room in a crappy flat with four Lithuanians who don't even talk to you, no living room. He still hasn't texted. Don't suppose he will now. Keep checking my phone just in case. I Keep hoping it will beep, and it does sometimes, but it's always work. Checking if I want to do another shift, I don't. Or Kelly wondering if I want to go for a drink, I don't. Or O2 asking if I want to upgrade my phone, I don't. Come on, phone, make a noise for me, please. I just want him to be in touch. I just want him to kiss me and hold me and stroke my hair and tell me everything's going to be all right. I used to play with my mum's hair when she was lying on sofa all hungover, and I thought she liked it, or maybe it might make her feel better, but she yelled at me one day. She said, "Stop stroking me, you stupid little cow. Do you think I'm a dog? I'm not your dog." I wonder what sort of dog Sean has. Oh. Hello again. You lot. Nice of you to finally turn up. You could have visited. No one visited, which is fine because I didn't want anyone to see me. Oh, I look a mess, don't I? He texted me. He didn't say anything very nice. He said, "If you don't leave me alone, I'll go to the police, you delusional bitch." Delusional? Good word, isn't it? I didn't know what it meant before. It's just because I made a joke. Oh, I didn't tell you about that, did I? You probably wouldn't get it. He didn't get it. Of course, I didn't mean I was actually going to go to the police to report him for attacking me. I put a smiley face on it. How could he even think I was being serious? It's insulting. That he would think I would lie about something like that to the police. It was a joke. So anyway, I went back to the river. Went wandering along to the Shard. I thought I saw him. I ran after him. It wasn't him. Doctor said I was lucky. I don't feel lucky, I feel like a twat. I wanted to throw myself into the river all dramatic, but the tide was out or something, so I just wandered down onto the sand and finished a bottle of vodka and kind of laid down and hoped the river would wash over me. There were some people around, but they didn't say anything. They didn't shout, "Don't do it, Delilah!" Why would they? They don't even know me. They just stared. I suppose one of them must have called an ambulance, or maybe there's CCTV, I don't know. I don't really remember the ambulance ride, but one of the paramedics told me, I just kept saying, "I want my mom, I want my mom, I want my mom, I don't want my mom, that's stupid, how stupid is that?" I'm fine now though. That's the main thing, I'm really fine. I've deleted my Tinder. I don't need a man. I don't need anyone, I don't even need my phone, I'm going to throw it away. No, that's silly. But I'm not going to use it for a while. Well, I should probably keep it on. Doctor said he might call. I have to go for appointments for counselling. It's rubbish, I'm fine. He's nice though. Really caring. Delilah, you have to learn to love yourself. All that self-help nonsense. But he was quite nice looking too. He looked at me like I mattered. No one ever looks at me like that. I wonder if he'll ring.
That was SMS, written by Marion Powell, and the part of Delilah was played by Emily Jane Kerr. Now, that piece was performed at a Blackshaw New Writing Night last year, and if you have any new writing and you'd like to see it performed, or even put on the radio like that was, head on over to blackshawonline.com and follow the links to the New Writing Night page. You'll find all of the information you need, and also when we're going to be having our next New Writing Night, which this month is the 25th, and it's going to be at the Horse and Stables in Lambeth. Next week on the show, we are getting ready for Blackshaw's next production, which is Alice in Wonderland, as part of the Wandsworth Arts Festival and Fringe. Now, next Sunday, we are shooting a trailer for the production, a visual trailer, and I'm going along to do some audio recording for the radio show, and also I'm going to try and bring some of the cast members back into the studio so we can chat about Alice in Wonderland and the play itself, which will be fun. Also, Matt will be back with his famous movie review, and we're probably going to be doing some more arts things of the week, so tune in for that. And to take us out tonight, this is a band that has recently been in London for the first time from Australia. They're called The Preachers, and this is their first single, "Is This How You Feel?"